It's Tuesday, March 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, differences remain amid a meeting between U.S. and Cuban presidents. The remaining White House candidates were in Washington ahead of more state primaries.
The supreme leader has to make sure that he maintains and protects Iran's revolutionary image.
Iran says the United States is blocking its advancement. The hunt for terror suspects continues in Turkey. Also ahead, a music love triangle. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Barack Obama hailed the progress in relations between the United States and Cuba while acknowledging that the two sides continue to have very serious differences on democracy and human rights.
Cuba is sovereign and rightly has great pride, and the future of Cuba will be decided by Cubans, not by anybody else. At the same time, as we do wherever we go around the world, I made it clear that the United States will continue to speak up on behalf of democracy, including the right of the Cuban people to decide their own future.
After frank and candid talks in Havana on ways to advance normalization efforts, Mr. Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro held a joint news conference. In his remarks, Castro welcomed the easing of trade and travel restrictions announced by Washington, but stressed the need for action to lift a 55-year trade embargo on the communist country. The U.S. trade embargo on Cuba can only be lifted by the Republican-controlled Congress, where there is disagreement about Obama's policy shift from isolation to engagement in Cuba. President Obama made the historic visit to Cuba early in his final year in office in a bid to make Washington's new approach toward Cuba essentially irreversible, that according to the White House. While the phone quality from Cuba makes conversation somewhat difficult at times, we feel there are important aspects of today's events that VOA White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas shares with us from Havana.
What a day of images that are just historic. We have them meeting after 55 years of these two countries being Cold War enemies, first president there in 80 years, and here they were sitting together and afterwards had a press conference, and the president of this communist nation actually took some questions. He was clearly not used to it. And so the upshot after these bilateral talks, Jim, is that they both praise the progress that has been made since they formalized diplomatic relations and as they are moving towards normalization. But they both say they still have serious disagreements, and there's still roadblocks ahead as they try to move forward. But they admitted those, but they both seem to be very happy about the progress and that this needs to continue to move forward.
It was a rather unusual press conference, and Raul Castro was asked about political prisoners. He said they had none.
That is an interesting thing. He was asked, why is it that you have political opposition figures of people in prison? And he said, show me a list of those that are political opposition figures in prison. The Deputy National Security Advisor then wrote for the media, and he said, look, here's why. In his view, he doesn't believe that they're political dissidents. He thinks that they are lawbreakers. He thinks they actually broke the law, and that's why they're in jail. Our position, the U.S. position, is that everyone universally should have freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and that no country has the right to throw people in jail because of this. Fundamentally, this Cuban government believes that's against the law. And so that's how they deadlock on that one. Progress has been made, according to the U.S., but not enough progress.
And there was a bit of an awkward handshake at the end as Raul Castro tried to grab President Obama's hand. It didn't quite make it.
Yeah, that's right. It was a very unusual press conference. There were a couple more questions, and Raul Castro said, he was just done with it. And you could tell he just was not used to people asking him the questions. So, in a way, I think, as one White House official said tonight, it was very illuminating.
definitely some points of disagreement between the United States and Cuba that still exist and need to be worked out. On a lighter note, they're going to take in a baseball game tomorrow.
They are, and I think it's after a historic speech. Once again, the president will address all students directly. That will be broadcast live. And we're going to have a baseball game between the Tampa Bay Rays and the Cuban national team. It speaks to a new policy that now Cubans are allowed to make money in the U.S., and that affects a lot of baseball teams because both countries love that. So it's going to be fun, but it's also meaningful, too.
The Cubans are just as passionate about baseball as we are in the United States.
Yes, correct.
Mary Alice Salinas, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's quite busy there, and we'll let you get back to work.
Thank you for doing it.
Republican candidates for the White House slammed Mr. Obama's trip to Cuba, but it was Donald Trump who was also being criticized online, as our social media correspondent G. Abby Lee joins us in the studio. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
What's buzzing online today?
Many people are closely following the back and forth between Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and GOP presidential frontrunner Donald Trump. On Facebook and Twitter, she called him a loser and also described him as a serious threat with embarrassing insecurities. She actually sent out 11 tweets about him, tagging him in every one of them. Her latest one reads like this: "We cannot elect wannabe tyrants to the White House. Not now, not ever. It's up to all of us to stop real Donald Trump." Her handle is at Elizabeth4MA.
All those tweets, that sounds like something Donald Trump would do. How did he respond?
He called her the Indian at a press conference. In the past, she mentioned her partial Native American ancestry, so that's what he was referring to. And it's actually not the first time Trump ridiculed her statement about her heritage. In an interview with the New York Times over the weekend, he said, "She has got about as much Indian blood as I have."
Well, that sounds like something Trump might say. Let's move on to President Obama's press conference with Cuban leader Raul Castro. What's the online reaction like on the handshake between the two leaders at the end of the conference?
Well, it was more like an arm shake, to be honest. So to briefly explain the handshake, it happened when the Cuban leader reached out to Mr. Obama's hand, but actually ended up grabbing his arm instead because of maybe the height difference. So it kind of looks like Mr. Castro is holding up Mr. Obama's hand by holding onto his wrist and kind of flopping it every which way. So a lot of people are commenting on how awkward it was. And among those who tweeted about it was Matt Drudge. Now he's an American political commentator and creator of the popular conservative news aggregator, The Drudge Report. He's on Twitter at Drudge, and the description box shows he joined Twitter back in 2011, but he didn't tweet anything until this month. And the latest of the three tweets is about the infamous handshake between the two leaders. He made a GIF out of the handshake and captioned it, "I am your puppet." About 1,000 people liked that tweet. Jim?
Well, thanks for the analysis, G. You may follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I post on Twitter at VOA Stevenson, and our international edition stream is at VOA_IE. Real estate mogul Donald Trump, who is the leading U.S. Republican presidential contender, spent Monday right here in Washington, unveiling the names of a few of his foreign policy advisors and trying to convince some skeptical lawmakers and advocates for Israel of his political credentials. The brash Trump has mostly stayed away from the nation's capital amid frequent predictions that his candidacy would flop as he has hurled insults against his political opponents and committed purported campaign gaffes that often would have ended weaker candidacies. Numerous conservative Republicans, although certainly not all, are trying to block his presidential nomination even as he heads closer to winning it. There are more primaries upon us as the remaining candidates appeared before an influential group of voters here in Washington. And for more, we're joined by VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone.
Well, the Tuesday races involve Arizona and Utah. Arizona primary, Utah a caucus. And in Arizona, the polls seem to suggest Donald Trump is doing pretty well. And that makes some sense if you think about his calling card, of course, is the border issue, stemming the flow of illegal immigration. So he's got some powerful allies down in Arizona who are working on his behalf. Now, that's a winner-take-all, so if he's able to get a win there, he would get a boost in the delegate count, which is really what it's all about now. Donald Trump would love to get to the magic number, which is 1,237 Republican delegates, before the convention in July so he can sort of clamp down on the nomination. Ted Cruz is giving him a run for his money in Utah. And thanks perhaps in part to the 2012 Republican nominee Mitt Romney, a Mormon who also has a lot of close ties in Utah. Cruz is hoping for a winner-take-all performance in Utah, but in order to do that, he would have to win at least 50% of the vote. So we'll see how that stands. But the battle will go on for a bit here, and unless Trump can pull away completely from the other two in the field, or unless Kasich and Cruz can start to stumble him up a bit, we're probably going to see this play out for a while.
Voters in these western states got to hear the candidates speak many, many miles away here in Washington today. Trump, as far as I've heard, gave the first speech of this campaign where he delivered a prepared text to media beforehand. He used a teleprompter. I don't know if that was a move to perhaps look a little more presidential.
It might have been. It might have been a move to keep him a little more disciplined. He has spoken to some groups before about Israel and said some things that have come back to haunt him. I think he was trying to be very careful. I must say, watching it, he looked a bit like a caged animal. he wanted to break out of that script mode a few times, I thought. But he got, a warm response, said he was a very staunch friend and defender of Israel. But as did the other presidential contenders who spoke, including Democrat Hillary Clinton and Trump's two Republican rivals, Ted Cruz and John Kasich. So it's a rite of passage. It's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, their annual meeting in Washington. It's the most influential pro-Israel group in the U.S. And so for all the candidates, it's an important stop to make. And perhaps Trump was able to sidestep a minefield that he may have stepped into previously. He also met with some members of the so-called Republican establishment, trying to get more and more of mainstream Republicans on board behind his campaign. Hard to see how that's going so far. I think that's going to be an ongoing effort for Donald Trump. He's got some people to win over, but his message is you should embrace me. I've brought millions of new voters into the Republican Party in the primaries, and I'm looking like the nominee. So you better get behind me while you can.
There has been this acrimonious push towards ousting Trump or preventing him from becoming the nominee.
Yeah, he doesn't come to Washington all that much. He's often running against Washington. The meeting was behind closed doors. The members of Congress are not well known, to be fair. They're not congressional leaders. So it shows that he has some work to do to get the Republican Party establishment behind him.
Following all of it for us, VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Jim.
This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei used the Persian New Year to take aim at the United States for what he perceived as continued animosity toward Iran. The Iranian spiritual leader said the Americans keep sanctions in place in a way that big companies, corporations, and banks would not dare come near the Islamic Republic. The Ayatollah also said the U.S. had no business trying to stop Iran from developing its defensive capabilities, including missiles. Iran analyst Shahram Akbarzadeh of Australia's Deakin University tells VOA's Victor Beatty there were two underlying reasons behind the spiritual leader's strident tone.
The supreme leader has to make sure that he maintains and protects Iran's revolutionary image. Iran has been anti-American from day one, and that's very much ingrained in the identity of the Iranian state. So what he is saying is that he wants to make sure that no one can accuse Iran of compromising its revolutionary anti-American identity and position. So that's the number one. So he is speaking to a large domestic audience in that regard, and probably also external audience, but primarily it's a domestic audience and it's the hardliners within Iran who have been critical of the nuclear deal. So he wants to assure them that Iran is going to continue its revolutionary anti-American, anti-Israel agenda. Secondly, I think he is referring to some of the sanctions that Iran is threatened with, especially with the ballistic program, Iran's missile program. And there are other sanctions imposed on Iran that weren't even related to the missile program or the nuclear program. You know, following the revolution, a lot of Iranian assets were frozen in the United States, and Iran has been accused of working with terrorists, so it's a sponsor of terrorists globally. And that has had implications. So there are a series of sanctions imposed on Iran, and that creates some challenges and hurdles for international banking. So I think he is mixing all of them together.
We've heard so many stories and seen so many reports about European countries, other foreign companies rushing to Iran to make deals. But are there some that are holding back?
I think by and large, trading with Iran has opened up, and a lot of companies are happy to trade, purchase Iranian goods, and send their own goods to sell in Iran. So import and export is benefiting, but investment in Iran, especially in the financial sector, is a lot more complicated, not only because there are question marks about whether sanctions will snap back, but also because the Iranian legal system isn't equipped to allow for direct foreign investment. So there is a lack of clarity in the regulations in Iran, and that is hampering foreign investment.
Shahram Akbarzadeh said he does not believe the international community, including veto-wielding Russia and China, will punish Iran over its missile tests with new UN sanctions, in part because the country, struggling with high unemployment, has yet to benefit fully from sanctions relief from the nuclear deal. Turkey's largest city, Istanbul, remains on edge after Saturday's suicide bombing that was blamed on Islamic State terrorists. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, concerns remain high as security forces continue to hunt for other suspects.
Fear continues to stalk Istanbul. Some parents kept their children away from school to avoid them having to use service buses. People are also avoiding public spaces amid fears of further attacks. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says his government is doing its utmost to confront the danger.
Terör örgütlerini darmadağın etmek, mensuplarının başlarını ezmek Türkiye için kolaydır.
Erdogan said Turkey's recently been facing one of the biggest and bloodiest terrorist waves in its history. He said the state is fighting terrorist organizations and the forces behind them with everything at its disposal, its soldiers, police, village guards, and intelligence. On Sunday, one of the biggest events on the country's sporting calendar, a match between Istanbul's top football teams, was cancelled. The decision was made just hours before kickoff by the city governor, who cited what he said were credible intelligence warnings of another attack. Turkish security sources cited in local media claim Islamic State is planning a major attack using suicide bombers and armed assailants similar to November's Paris attack. Istanbul police have released images of three suspects believed to be linked to Saturday's Istanbul bomber, who killed four people and injured dozens more. The suspects are reportedly potential suicide bombers. Turkish police sources say, from studying closed-circuit television images, the bomber targeted a group of Israeli tourists and that he tracked them from their hotel. 3 Israelis were killed and 11 injured. Deputy Chairman Engin Altai of the main opposition, Republican People's Party, says the government has to share some responsibility for Saturday's attack. Altay said what the country is going through now is a result of the ruling AK Party's unstable, contradictory, utopian, adventure-seeking policies in the Middle East. The opposition, along with some of Turkey's Western allies, have accused the government of ignoring the threat of Islamic State and other jihadist groups in Syria to focus too heavily on fighting Kurdish rebels. Interior Minister Efkan Ala admitted Sunday security forces are struggling to stop the bombers. More than 200 people have been killed in 5 suicide attacks since October in Ankara or Istanbul. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. They were country music's power couple, Miranda Lambert and Blake Shelton. Their divorce took everyone by surprise, and soon after the announcement, Blake Shelton bonded with his colleague on the TV show The Voice and fellow recent divorcee, pop star Gwen Stefani. While the love lives of all three have been fodder for the tabloids, now the public will hear from the artists themselves through their medium of choice, music. Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to break it all down.
Okay, Nikki, so let's start with Gwen Stefani. She's got a new CD out.
Yes, she has a new CD. It's called This Is What the Truth Feels Like, and it is indeed about her boyfriend, Blake Shelton, and her divorce from Gavin Rossdale and everything that she's been through. So she shares that when she first presented the list of songs to her label, they were like, these are too personal, too intense. So in response, she rebelled and said, you know what, now I'm going to make it even that much more intense and personal. And she has. The songs are very catchy, and when it comes to Blake, we find out that she really sees him as saving her and that she is definitely in love. Some of the lyrics for the song, for example, Where Would I Be? It says, I was drifting out, then you pulled me in. Where would I be, boy, if you didn't love me, boy? I can't resist. You have the perfect kiss. But she goes on to sing about how he's rare, he's a sapphire, and she really sings his praises. She's obviously in love.
Well, now, Blake Shelton is also releasing new music, correct?
Yeah, now, he just released a single called Come Here to Forget, which tells the story of two people bonding while trying to forget their exes. So he didn't write the song, but the parallels are undeniable. And it really is the perfect setup for his forthcoming album, which he says will also be very personal and will most likely include songs about Gwen Stefani and, of course, his ex-wife, Miranda Lambert.
Well, now, Miranda Lambert, she's releasing music as well.
Yeah, she's working on stuff. We have nothing yet about whether she's going to release something this year, but she is like the odd woman out. So when the announcement came that they were divorced, she was really reeling from that divorce. She really felt her pain based on the various things she said. And in the interim, Blake was developing this relationship with Gwen Stefani. And so rumors were flying in the tabloids. And then the night of the American Country Association Awards, where Miranda was nominated for, they make the official announcement that they're a couple, which of course made a lot of country fans feel a certain kind of way, because it was like, you know, dude, could you wait till afterwards?
Yeah.
But now that she has a new romance blooming with an artist, Anderson East, she's now inspired and she's writing music and she's talking a little bit about her process. So we anticipate that she will release her version of events and her life pre and post divorce. If not this year, hopefully sometime early next year.
Very fruitful material there. Well, Gwen Stefani's new CD is called This Is What the Truth Feels Like. You can hear music from Gwen Stefani, Blake Shelton, and Miranda Lambert on VOA One. You can also reach Nikki Strong on social media at @VOA_music and on Facebook at simply VOA Music. Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you.
Where'd you go? I got so used to being around you, boy. I'm trying not to care, but where'd you go? I'm doing my best to
leave. Oh, nothing like breakups, makeups, triangles, and intrigue. You can go steady with us just by staying with International Edition in a variety of ways. Listen to us the way you're listening right now. You can always stop by our website, voanews.com as well, stream our program or download it if you like. And you can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jonah Cummings. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Safe drinking water is fundamental to healthy lives and prosperous communities. To focus attention on the importance of clean water and to advocate for the sustainable management of fresh water resources, on March 22nd of every year, we observe International World Water Day. Every person needs at least 20 liters of water per day for drinking, cooking, sanitation, and hygiene needs alone. Yet some 2 billion people worldwide do not have access to safe drinking water, and more than 2.4 billion people do not have access to improved sanitation for adequate disposal of human waste. People who do not have access to clean water and sanitation are at greatly increased risk of infectious diseases, which can lead to physical and cognitive impairments and premature death. Contaminated water and poor sanitation are among the main causes of severe diarrheal diseases in the very young, the second leading cause of death in children under 5 years old. According to the World Health Organization, or WHO, some 760,000 young children die of diarrheal diseases across the world every year. It is further estimated that as few as 5 incidences of diarrhea in children under the age of 2 can lead to lifelong effects, such as developmental delays and stunting. Clearly, an adequate supply of safe water and access to basic sanitation are the most basic necessities of life. But the importance of clean water goes so much further than the assurance of hydration and cleanliness. This year's theme for the United Nations World Water Day is Better Water, Better Jobs. The slogan is meant to bring attention to the fact that nearly all jobs, regardless of the sector, depend directly on water. Cleaner water makes for a safer, more productive environment, results in healthier food, and contributes to a greener economy and sustainable development. But ensuring that people everywhere have access to all the clean water they need, where they need it, when they need it, reliably and sustainably, requires global cooperation. On this World Water Day, the United States remains steadfast in our commitment to achieving a water-secure future, and we invite all stakeholders to partner with us to save water and save lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is for